This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. That tax credit for first-time home buyers is hugely popular. Too popular, it turns out. For those who qualify, it's like getting $8,000 cash back from the government. The IRS handed out nearly $10 billion in credits through August. But the agency's internal watchdog says thousands of people who benefited may not actually be first-time homebuyers. A congressional committee is looking into the matter today. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
Some of these suspicious claims come from people who are writing off interest payments on another house. That's a pretty strong sign they already own a house. Russell George is the inspector general that watches over the IRS. He says it's bewildering that the IRS set up the program the way it did.
This is one of the largest refundable credits in the history of the Internal Revenue Service. As they are well aware, there are people who do not want to pay taxes, that if you give them any opportunity to avoid paying it, certain people will.
In a recent audit, George's office highlighted nearly $500 million in homebuyer tax credits claimed by people who don't appear to qualify. At today's House Ways and Means Committee hearing, he's expected to release another, more damning report. His biggest complaint, and something he's been talking about for months, is that the IRS doesn't require people applying for the credit to prove that they've actually purchased a house.
If the IRS were to require documentation of the purchase of a home, that would serve as a major disincentive to people who would otherwise fraudulently claim the credit.
But the IRS has resisted this. Frank Keith is a spokesman for the agency.
It would not necessarily give us the ability to just automatically disallow the claim.
Because he says the IRS doesn't have the authority to reject a claim for the tax credit without doing a full audit first. Keith says his agency has flagged more than 100,000 tax returns for a second look. He says many of the claims that are getting audited will turn out to be legitimate, but not all of them.
I think we'll find some where the taxpayer perhaps has made an honest mistake, and I think we'll find those cases in which the taxpayer intentionally filed a return claiming a credit, knowing full well that they weren't eligible.
Just yesterday, a tax preparer in Florida was sentenced to 30 months behind bars for filing false tax returns. He claimed the homebuyer credit for 15 of his clients and told some of them they could qualify even if they were merely thinking about buying a house. Bill Lazor says he's not surprised that things like this are happening. He's a certified public accountant from Kingston, Pennsylvania.
It's being touted as free money. If it's so easy to get, that makes the bad guys devise schemes to help people get the credit who shouldn't have it.
This comes as the popular tax credit nears its expiration date, and some are pushing Congress to extend and even expand the program. Democratic Congressman Earl Pomeroy says today's hearing will look at what to do about the fraud.
I'm very disturbed by the inspector general indicating that there might have been more than 70,000 claims by people that aren't buying their first home. If somehow they are routinely being allowed the credit, we've got a major problem. We need to stop it.
Lucien Salvan is with the National Association of Realtors, which loves the tax credit and doesn't like the talk of fraud.
That kind of thing is to the detriment of a very workable tax credit plan to help home buyers get into the market. It's starting to stabilize prices in the housing market, and that's something everybody wants to do.
If the tax credit is extended, you can bet there will be some new measures built in to make sure the only people who get a tax credit are the ones who deserve it. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're going to ask next about the implications of a big decision by the Catholic Church. The Vatican is welcoming Anglicans to return to Catholicism. The public invitation comes as the Anglican Church is divided over questions like the role of gays. If some Anglican congregations become Catholic now, they could bring their Anglican priests along, and the priests could become Catholic even if they're married. That calls attention to the Vatican's longtime rule that priests must be celibate. To learn more, we contacted John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter.
There have always been celibate priests in the Catholic Church. In the beginning, these were largely monks who embraced celibacy as a symbol of total self-sacrifice to the service of God and God's people. However, the expectation that most Catholic priests are going to be celibate really didn't arise until the 10th or 11th century. So it has been for about the last 1,000 years that the Catholic Church has had a fairly uniform policy that its priests are going to not marry, that is, are going to be celibate.
And what is the reason that the Vatican gives for holding to that rule even today?
Well, I think there are reasons that are both theological and practical. The theological reason is that a priest actually is married. The priest is married to Christ and to Christ's church. And in that sense, if you'll pardon the flippant expression, it would almost be kind of bigamy to have another married relationship. I think the practical reason is that when priests are not married, that means that they are kind of available 24/7 to the service of the church.
So having said that they have this reason, that the priest is married to the church and married to the calling, what reason does the Vatican then give for saying it would be okay for Anglicans, in effect, to become married Catholic priests?
It is, in effect, a kind of choice for diversity inside the Catholic Church. Now, it should be said, for centuries, the Catholic Church has had 21 Eastern Rite churches. These are churches that are located mostly in Eastern Europe. In those Eastern Rite churches, priests are allowed to be married. So there have always been, in that sense, churches that have married priests that are in communion with Rome. So in principle, this isn't any different. I think the big difference is that where those churches tend to be located in places far away from centers of media attention in the West, these new structures that the Catholic Church is creating for Anglicans are going to be located in the United States, in Great Britain, in Canada, and in those places where the debate over priestly celibacy in many ways already is the most intense.
And is that debate heating up now in the Catholic circles that you follow so closely?
Yeah, I mean, already there are a lot of people asking questions about what the implications of this move are going to be. I mean, if, for example, the Vatican says that it's not just current Anglican ministers who can be married and ordained as Catholic priests, but future candidates for the priesthood can be married inside these new structures. I mean, will you see a growing number of young Catholic men who will say, well, geez, I'd like to be a priest and I'd like to be married. Maybe I can sign up for one of these new structures and do it that way. I mean, in other words, the question that's being asked is, has the Vatican, without intending to, created a loophole big enough to drive a Mack truck through on the discipline of priestly celibacy?
It's interesting to think that you would have Anglican priests who are drifting away from the Anglican Church, feeling that they're conservative and that the Church is becoming far too liberal, and now they have the prospect of joining the Catholic Church and becoming the liberal guys who are actually married.
Well, they may be liberal on the married priests question, but on most other issues, whatever number of Anglicans actually come into the Catholic Church, they're going to end up bolstering the more conservative wing of the Catholic Church, because on most issues, particularly issues of sexual morality, they're quite traditional. And this makes a larger point, which is that in the old days, the differences that mattered among Christians were things like how much authority did you give to the Pope versus how much authority did you give to the Bible and so on. And while those differences are still around, these days the differences that actually drive behavior on the ground are more ideological. They're about the culture wars. And so what we're seeing is a real redefinition of the fault lines that matter in Christianity.
And maybe some people stepping across the fault line.
That's exactly what's happening.
John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter, always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve.
If you're pregnant, have small children, or if you know someone who's given birth, or even if you've visited the childbirth section of a bookstore, you probably have seen the bevy of What to Expect books. What to expect when you're expecting, what to expect the toddler years, what to eat when you're expecting. Well, a new book offers a different perspective. What to Expect When You Are Expected. It's billed as a fetus's guide to the first three trimesters. And don't expect to find practical advice in these pages. However, you might find various oddities, and you'll definitely find some belly laughs. David Javerbaum wrote this book, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now, the cover of this book does look like it's in the family of What to Expect books, those books that are published by Workman Publishing Group.
Right, and those books, by the way, are a parody of mine. My book is What to Expect When You're Expected. It's the original. What to Expect When You're Expecting is a parody that's fooled, I think, up to 30 million people at this point. But my book, make no mistake, is the original.
You really are, as I understand, trying to help the folks that are in utero communicate in some way with those who are expecting them to enter the world at some point. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I was hoping that hopefully after reading this book, fetuses will emerge better prepared to handle some of the challenges of modern 21st century society. I have two kids of my own, and both times I would go to the hospital when they were born, I'd go to the maternity ward, and I would see this new generation being born. I call them Generation XXXY. And, you know, they're naked and they're screaming and they're incoherent. They're placed in an isolated part of the hospital for their own good and for the protection, I think, frankly, of the other people. And it was disturbing. As an American, I don't like seeing, you know, the next generation of Americans in that kind of condition. And so my hope is that this will help put them in a better place.
There's a very funny bit in the book about baby names. Do you have the book with you?
I do.
It starts on page 175. Let's go there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind reading just a bit of that?
Absolutely. Your name has no doubt been the subject of much discussion between your parents. He likes Zoe. She thinks it sounds precious. She likes Samantha. He thinks it sounds quaint. They both like Morgan. The world thinks Morgan sounds stupid. So Morgan it is. That's the thing about your name. It's essentially genetic, determined by your parents as surely as your DNA. And though you may one day legally change it, in your heart, you will remain the same adorable newborn whose parents held you in their arms and repeated the phrase, "Hello, Wizu Maximus," over and over again.
Hmm. Now, you also go through name categories, and some of these are a lot of fun. Place names.
Place names, these are, you know, this has been common for years now. For boys, you have your Bryce or Zion, Yellowstone. Carlsbad Caverns.
There's
very
no
funny
one
name.
Named Carlsbad Caverns.
Oh, well, I'm not sure where you're looking, Michelle, but where I'm from here in New York, a lot of kids, a lot of newborns are named Carlsbad Caverns. And girls, you have London, Paris, Brussels, and Luxembourg City is actually a burgeoning name.
Known as Elsie.
Elsie would be a good nickname for that.
I want to ask you about one of the questions you pose in the book. Why do my parents blast Mozart at me every night when I'm just trying to sleep?
Yeah, that's a common thing. Your parents want the best for you, and they want you to be better than themselves, not suffer from the same failings that they believe that they have. And one of your parents' failings is that they never, ever listen to classical music. And so they're going to inflict their guilt about that on you. So you have to sit there and essentially get an involuntary 9-month subscription to your very own Mostly Mozart festival in there, in a room with very bad acoustics. And the sad thing is there are so many other pieces of music that would be more appropriate in the fetal environment.
Such as?
I've Got You Under My Skin by Frank Sinatra would be a wonderful choice. You know, Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash. That's a very appropriate one for later. With or Without You. That's more for conjoined twins. But there's a lot of other songs that really can work, you know, in that environment.
David, it has been fun to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Michelle.
David Jabberbaum is the author of the book What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters, the first ever guide to pregnancy for the prenatal reader written by a former embryo. He writes for The Daily Show.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris in Washington.
And I'm Melissa Block in California. As Congress wrestles with its health care overhaul, Massachusetts is entering its fourth year under a sweeping law that requires nearly everybody to get insurance. At this point, fewer than 3% of residents are uninsured. That's the lowest percentage in the nation. Critics say the Massachusetts approach costs too much and creates an overload of newly insured patients. But as NPR's Richard Knox reports, a new poll says one important group likes the law.
It's 12:30 and Dr. Phil Trifletti is grabbing a quick lunch.
Leftover chicken from the weekend. One of my wife's recipes. It's a chicken pesto.
Trifletti's a busy primary care doctor in the working class town of Chelsea, just north of Boston. The thing that's different these days is that virtually all of his patients are insured, thanks to the 2006 law.
It's certainly nicer for me to be able to be available to more patients in my community.
Over the past couple of years, there have been reports that so many people have signed up for coverage that primary care doctors can't handle the load. That's not the case here. If you call Phil Trifletti's office as a new patient, you'll get an appointment in about 3 weeks.
You know, I can't say that we've been swamped or overwhelmed. I don't feel swamped by it in any way.
Trifletti's not unusual. The new poll shows most Massachusetts doctors think the law's working pretty well.
They are very supportive of the law. 70% said they favored the law and overwhelmingly wanted it continued.
Dr. Robert Blendon of the Harvard School of Public Health ran the poll. It's published online today by the New England Journal of Medicine. Blendon says previous polls show the general public likes the new law, but doctors like it even more.
They were just quite impressed, both in their own practice and statewide, that the uninsured problem has essentially disappeared from their lives.
And doctors don't think the law's affected their quality of care at all. Patients still get the same amount of time with the doctors, and only 13% of doctors think their payments are too low. When the law was passed, people worried that insuring hundreds of thousands of new patients would result in long waiting lists. Well, 62% of the doctors in this survey say, in their practice, it's not a problem. Again, Robert Blendon.
They did see shortage of primary care services as a problem in the state, but two-thirds did not think it was a problem brought on by the legislation.
Now, not all doctors say they love the law. 7% would like to see it repealed. But a spokesman for the Massachusetts Medical Society says it's hard to find a doctor to say so publicly. Many Massachusetts doctors are worried about the cost of insuring everybody, so as the general population, polls say. There's growing consensus that something serious needs to be done about the cost of health care, which is heavily subsidized by the state. But for now, the doctor's verdict on the Massachusetts health care plan is surprisingly positive.
All right, so let's have you sit up on the bench there. We'll listen to your lungs and check your blood pressure again.
Phil Trifletti, the primary care doctor in Chelsea, Massachusetts, is back to work.
Next deep breath. Let out. Your lungs sound perfect.
Trifletti is happy to hear that most Massachusetts doctors feel the way he does about how things are going.
I'm glad it's popular, and I think it has worked well. And I fully agree that, you know, having doctors supported is a good thing, and I hope that that has some political clout in Washington.
But Trifletti says what's really going to count is whether Massachusetts can continue funding its popular new health care program in the face of whopping budget deficits and big budget cuts. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh has stirred up another controversy with some of his latest comments. He lashed out this week at a New York Times reporter, calling him part of, quote, a radical environmental movement. That reporter is Andrew Rifkin. As NPR's David Folkenflik explains, Rifkin could be considered fairly revolutionary, but perhaps not in the way Limbaugh thinks.
This is what listeners heard Tuesday on Rush Limbaugh's show.
This guy from the New York Times, if he really thinks that humanity is destroying the planet, humanity is destroying the climate, that human beings in their natural existence are going to cause the extinction of life on Earth. Andrew Rifkin. Mr. Rifkin, why don't you just go kill yourself and help the planet by dying?
For the record, Andrew Rifkin has no such plans. His first long article on climate change appeared in Discover magazine 21 years ago, and his coverage now focuses on the question of how the world can grow to its projected population of 9 billion people over the next 40 years with as little damage as possible.
My way is to say, what do we know? What don't we know? What can we learn? What's essentially unknowable? And then what does society do with that body of information that's left?
I spoke with Rifkin in the Times newsroom in Midtown Manhattan, but he's been all over the world tracking the effects of climate change, including the North Pole and Greenland, for which he filed online dispatches. That grew into a blog called Dot Earth, now just 2 years old. It's a new role for someone who had been a conventional, though distinguished, print reporter.
It's more like being a mountain guide after an avalanche than being, the old style, here's the news, take it or leave it. Thank you very much. Good night.
Rifkin posts his own reporting and links to government documents and scientific journal articles, as well as stories from other news outlets. And he often solicits and publishes the opinions of readers, all the while helping them sift through the flood of information coming their way. Bud Ward is editor of the Yale Forum on Climate Change and the Media. Ward says Rifkin is one of the leading reporters in the field.
If Andy's reporting attributes reliability, confidence to a particular set of scientific findings, that certainly has carried a lot of weight within the journalism community generally.
And as Ward points out, that community is shrinking all the time.
Fewer reporters covering fewer stories for a smaller audience in a smaller news hole. It's a tough, tough issue. It's not the kind of issue any general assignment reporter can pick up on day one.
Andrew Revkin says editors have prodded him to write more for the print edition. After all, it has a larger audience and still pays the bills, despite all the growth and promise of the web.
That's been said to me about a year ago, and I've been in print more. But I haven't slowed down on the blog.
Revkin says that productivity comes at a cost.
I've made missteps. I've made probably more mistakes this year in my print stories than I had before, and that's kind of frustrating.
But New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen says Revkin's reporting is greatly enhanced by the feedback he gets from readers and sources online and in plain view.
Those are the kinds of pressures, the pressure to be in the paper regularly, to be on the front page, that have kept traditional reporters from really exploring what the web, the two-way web, the read-write, back-and-forth nature of the web can do for their reporting. One day, all beat reporting will be done this way, but for now, we have to make progress in small steps, and I think Revkin is doing that.
His tone is less formal online, and the sensitive nature of the climate change debate can lead him into controversial areas. Such was the case a few weeks ago at a public forum in Washington, D.C. Revkin spoke long distance by internet video phone, so the audio doesn't reproduce very well. But as he puts it now, he encouraged those in the audience to take part in what he called a thought experiment.
And in this case, I was asking a question about population and carbon. And it got conflated with those who are making strong statements about depopulating the world and that kind of thing.
Specifically, he asked whether families with fewer children should get financial credits for having smaller carbon emissions, as businesses would under some proposed policies. Which leads us back to Rush Limbaugh.
An environmental writer mainstreams an idea floating around the green fringe.
Limbaugh said Revkin was part of a movement to forcibly limit families to a single child, as occurred in China. He also compared the Times reporter to Palestinian suicide bombers. For his part, Andrew Revkin says Limbaugh owes an apology to Revkin's wife and two sons, especially the one who's a regular Limbaugh listener and who is now, the reporter says, serving in the Israeli military. David Folkenflik, NPR News.